This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
Lindsay Moore here.
Hello, Tom Haynes is my name.
Hi, I'm Chris Cardozo.
And we're joined by Sonia Usach-Kuntz.
McLaughlin's Ghost, an Oregon ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Dr. John McLaughlin came to the Pacific Northwest with the Hudson Bay Company and fell in love with the area. After losing his job, he was fired for giving supplies to settlers. He bought land in the Willamette Valley and founded the town now known as Oregon City. McLaughlin divided up the land into 300 plots, which he gave to the poor and needy who had traveled west searching for a new home. He later was elected mayor of the city. Oregon City became the destination of choice for many of the folks traveling on the Oregon Trail. When McLaughlin House was opened to the public as a museum, it swiftly became clear that someone was haunting the building. People began seeing a shadowy figure walking along the hallway and entering the room where John McLaughlin once slept. The smell of tobacco smoke sometimes permeates this smoke-free building, and it was commonly known that McLaughlin was a smoker. And sometimes footsteps sound in the corridor upstairs when no one is in the building. Perhaps McLaughlin returns occasionally to check up on his old home?
Bloody Mary Returns, a Montana ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. My stepmother was vile. I guess most kids think that when their father remarries, but in this case it was true. She only married father because he was rich, and she hated children. There were three of us, me, Marie, my middle brother Richard, and my youngest brother Charles. We were the price my stepmother Gerda paid for being rich, and we were all that stood between her and inheriting father's money when he died. So she took steps against us. She sent my youngest brother Charles away to boarding school overseas. The school had a good scholarly reputation, but it also had the reputation for being a hard school that was full of bullies and strict discipline. Not a place where a delicate child like Charles, who had been sickly as a baby, would thrive. He was miserable there. Somehow Gerda contrived to keep him there for all but the summer holidays, and when he came home the first year, he was pale and thin, with dark circles under his eyes that looked like bruises. He cried. He actually cried when Father told him he had to go back to the school. But Father didn't listen to him. Gerda thought it would be good for Charles to go there, and so Charles went. I did everything I could, encouraging letters and daily phone calls, until Gerda said it was too expensive and restricted calls to 5 minutes once a month. I even got Father to book me a ticket to Europe so I could visit Charles. Gerda was enraged when she found out. Her blue eyes went so cold it made chills run up my spine, and her pink mouth thinned into a bitter line that bade ill for me since I had dared to interfere. 2 days before my plane left for Europe, the school called and told us that Charles had climbed to the tallest tower and flung himself off. He was dead. Father was shocked, of course, and Gerda was quietly triumphant. For a few months, Father paid more attention to Richard and myself than he had since our mother died. But Gerda was beautiful, and had winning ways about her that soon drew my father's attention away. And now that one of her hated stepchildren was dead, she focused on another. Poor Richard was next. Richard was a sturdy chap who was about to enter high school, and he was really into sports. He would have thrived at the boarding school that had killed Charles, so Goethe sent him to an arts school instead. He hated it, but Goethe had told Father he had talent, so there he went. You would think my father would have learned his lesson with Charles, but Richard was a survivor, and he grimly practiced piano and violin when he would rather have played soccer and football. But Goethe was clever. She introduced Richard to a couple of high school boys who were everything Richard craved to be: rich, popular, on the football team, and into drugs. Goethe made sure Richard had a very large allowance and kept increasing it as Richard was drawn deeper and deeper under their influence. Until one day Richard overdosed, and Goethe had only one stepchild left, me. I was sure that Goethe knew Richard was doing drugs in his room that day. She knew he was ill and possibly dying in there. If she'd found him even 10 minutes sooner, his life would have been saved. So said the doctor, and I believed him. But Father wouldn't believe me. He was angry whenever I said anything against Goethe and told me to hold my tongue. Still, I knew I was next, and I was sure that Father would not live long after willing his fortune over to his wife. I decided that if Goethe got too bad, I would run away and live secretly with my aunt in New Jersey until I turned 18. From the moment Richard's body was found in his room, I forced myself to be a model child. My homework was done on time. I was polite to Goethe and all her friends. I went on all the family excursions with Goethe and Father, even the dangerous ones, like shark fishing. You can be sure that I took care to be seasick indoors and stayed away from the edge of the boat. Goethe was clever with her tricks. Everyone thought it was an accident the time we were out shopping and I fell onto the subway in front of an oncoming train. I managed to roll out of the way on time, but it was way too close for comfort. I had almost decided to run away when my father brought me the sad news that my aunt in New Jersey had died suddenly in her sleep, poisoned by person or persons unknown. I was appalled. How had Goethe known? But she had. I could tell from the smirk on her face. I went to my room that night and locked myself in to think. I could run away, but the money wouldn't last long, and I'd need to finish high school or my chances of getting a job were nil. Besides, Goethe would still be out there somewhere. If she could hire someone to poison my only living relative, besides Father, she could hire someone to kill me, whether I was living at home or not. There was only one thing I could think of, and it was a terrible thing, a family secret passed down from my mother's side for many generations. It involved a witch named Bloody Mary, who had once tried to kill my many times great-grandmother and use the child's blood to make herself young and beautiful forever. The witch had been stopped by the child's father, my many times great-grandfather, in the nick of time, and the witch had cursed him as she burned at the stake, cursed his mirror and the mirrors of all men who had condemned her to death at the stake, so that anyone saying her name in front of those mirrors would invoke her vengeful spirit. The story had gotten mixed up over the years, as it was passed down first in their village and then all over the country. These days, school kids everywhere scared themselves silly, chanting Bloody Mary's name in front of darkened mirrors during sleepover parties, and nothing happened to them. So no one really believed in the curse. Of course, no one knew the real story of Bloody Mary. That was a deep secret handed down by the villagers of long ago. But I was a direct descendant, and I knew how to summon the witch. You had to use a mirror owned by someone in the direct bloodline of one of the original families that lived in Bloody Mary's village. And the witch's name must be spoken by candlelight a certain number of times in their native tongue. It was an evil thing to do, I knew, but it was the only way to save my life. It was either Goethe or me. If I didn't fight back, I was dead. So I took my hard-earned money and went out to a specialty store to buy hand-dipped beeswax candles, black ones. I followed my mother's directions carefully, placing them at certain intervals around the living room so that they reflected in the huge mirror behind the couch. Then I lit each one, speaking the spell passed down in my mother's family, and I waited. Father was away on a business trip, and Goethe was out at a party with her latest boyfriend. She came home late and scolded me for staying up to study. Her voice was playful and light. I hated that voice. It made her sound like she was nice. But there was also a note of suspicion underlying her words, and she stared hard at the flickering black candles. "Holding a séance, little Marie?" she asked, emphasizing the word little, knowing I hated when she called me that. "I just like working by candlelight," I said mendaciously, turning a page in my textbook. Goethe frowned. "You know, little Marie, I think it's time we had a talk," she said, walking over to the mirror behind the couch and primping her hair. "Yes," I said softly, "we should. You killed my brothers and my aunt, but I won't let you kill me." Goethe laughed. "As if you had a chance against me," she said, fluffing her long blonde hair up behind her shoulders. I spoke the name of Bloody Mary in the native tongue of my ancestors. Once, twice, three times. Inside the mirror, the image of Goethe burst into flames, and another face looked out. It was the malevolent face of a twisted old crone, ruined with age and altogether evil. I ducked behind the chair as Goethe gave a scream of sheer terror, her eyes fixed on the witch. As I watched from my hiding place, heat burst forth from the mirror, blistering her beautiful alabaster skin. I could hear the flames roaring as the witch laughed evilly and held out her arms toward my stepmother.
"Goethe!"
croned Bloody Mary.
"Come to me, Goethe!"
And she took my stepmother into her arms. Goethe's terrified scream was suddenly cut off. The flames disappeared as suddenly as they had come. When I peeked out from behind the couch, Goethe and Bloody Mary were gone. I called Father at his hotel the next morning to tell him that Goethe hadn't slept at home. Well, it was true. He wasn't pleased. He called a few of her friends from his hotel room and quickly discovered she had been carrying on with another man. With several, if the truth be known. Father hated infidelity. He flew home at once to confront Goethe. But she was still missing, presumed run away with one of the flames. Somehow Father managed to divorce Goethe without ever trying to find her. And since she had no family in the area except us, everyone accepted the cover story, and no one ever tried to locate her. Goethe was gone for good. Father and I were safe at last.
The Old Bridge, a Texas ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. Old Man McManor was the foulest-tempered fellow you ever did see, but he owned and operated the only sawmill over in Camden, so folks had to deal with him. Whenever anyone didn't pay on time or crossed him, he'd take out his horsewhip and flail at them until they ran away cussing or broke down crying. One evening, McManor was out riding when a coyote scared his horse and it bolted. McManor was thrown down next to the bridge by the sawmill, and his head broke right open. Died instantly. There was a general sigh of relief when the sawmill was taken over by a nice fellow who moved to Texas from Kansas. Everyone thought they'd seen the last of McManor, until one night when Jerry Jones, an old enemy of McManor, made his way home via the old sawmill bridge after drinking at the tavern. Jerry was halfway across the old bridge when a plume of green steam came rising up through the boards of the bridge. He stopped and watched the mist solidify into the translucent body of Old Man McManor. The specter flourished his whip at poor, drunken Jerry, who screamed in terror and went running back the way he had come, with the ghost hard on his heels. When Jerry reached the giant pecan tree that shaded the road, the ghost of Old Man McManor vanished at once with another popping sound. Since Jerry had a reputation for drinking, no one believed his story until the ghost challenged the local parson on Sunday and didn't stop till the preacher recited some scripture. McManor continued to harass the townspeople for years, until the First World War, when folks began driving cars that were fast enough that the ghost couldn't catch them. Folks figured the ghost would give up haunting the bridge after the town got so modern, but mean old McManor still had one last hurrah in him, and it was a doozy. The local football team was driving home in a bus one night after winning a big game, when all at once the bus stalled right in front of McManor's bridge. Well, the boys started joking around about the ghost until they noticed that the road outside was glowing green. The boys nudged one another nervously and then turned to look out the rear window of the bus, right into the twisted smile of Old Man McManor. The boys started shrieking, the teachers chiming in just as loud, and the ghost of Old Man McManor lifted up the back of the bus as if it weighed no more than a rabbit. The team tumbled out of their seats, screaming and praying, and the football coach bravely climbed up the sloping aisle, waving a fist at the ghost in the strange, pulsing green light. Just then, the sheriff came roaring over the bridge on the opposite side of the road. As soon as his headlights illuminated the ghost holding the bus, Old Man McManor vanished with a popping sound. The sheriff slammed on his brakes in shock as the school bus and the team crashed to the ground. It wasn't long after this event that they built a new highway and the old bridge was torn down. The ghost of Old Man McManor hasn't been seen since.
The Skeleton, a New Mexico ghost story, retold by S.C. Schlosser. The boy had been out looking for work all day with no luck. When night fell, he was far from home. He decided to spend the night in an empty, run-down house. The minute he laid down, he fell into a sound sleep. The boy was awakened quite suddenly by a thump on the roof. With pounding heart, he sat up and lit a candle. A voice called out, "I'm falling down." The boy scrambled out of the way, just as a skeletal arm came crashing to the floor. The voice shouted again, "I'm falling down," and another arm landed beside the first, then a leg, the chest, and a second leg. Before he could count to 10, a complete skeleton was standing in front of him, grinning madly. The boy lifted his chin and grinned back, determined not to show his fear. The skeleton, delighted by the boy's spirit, and said, "You have courage, son. Are you brave enough to wrestle me?" The boy was terrified, but did not dare refuse the strange apparition. The skeleton and the boy wrestled back and forth, up and down the room. Remembering a trick his older brother had taught him, he twisted suddenly and threw the skeleton onto the ground. "You've won," the skeleton said. "Such courage deserves a reward. Come, I will give you my treasure." The boy was startled. What kind of treasure could an old skeleton have? "Pick me up and carry me on your back to the next room," said the skeleton. "Remember to take your candle." The boy picked up the skeleton and put it on its back. Then he retrieved his candle from the corner of the room and carried the skeleton into the next room. As they passed through the doorway, the skeleton blew out the candle. "Now stop that," he said, annoyed. The skeleton cackled madly. The boy lit the candle again, and the skeleton blew it out. "I'm going to drop you," the boy threatened. He lit the candle again, and again the skeleton blew it out. The boy dropped the skeleton onto the floor. "I will break all your bones," he said. Impressed, the skeleton said, "You are so courageous and strong. I will let you see my treasure." The boy lit the candle and turned to look into the room. It was filled with piles and piles of gold and silver and jewels. "I want you to promise me something," the skeleton said. The boy drew his gaze reluctantly from the magnificent treasure and looked at the skeleton. "I want you to promise me that you will gather all the poor people you can find in one day and give them each a bag of money. The rest you can keep for yourself." It would be a good thing to share his wealth with the needy, the boy decided, so he agreed to do what the skeleton had asked. The skeleton gave a happy laugh and began to disappear, piece by piece, first his head, then his leg, then his chest, then his other leg, and so on, until he was gone. The boy did just as he had promised, and when he finished his task, he took the rest of the treasure back to his family. They lived in comfort all of their days.
Ghostly lovers have been recorded for a while. Whether they are real or the fantasy of lonely women, we may never know. Unless, of course, one of us gets a visit on some cold, dark night. Mrs. June of Yorkshire, England, a mature woman with a 10-year-old son, became obsessed with her Ouija board. This led, in turn, to automatic writing, the entity she had contacted being a long-dead spirit named Leonardo. He may be dead, but he still knew how to write a good love letter, or so Mrs. June claimed. He even claimed to have wanted a child with her. A few weeks after the automatic writing had started, Mrs. June saw a shadow floating above her bed and felt her bedclothes move. Leonardo had arrived and was, it seemed, furious over her use of birth control pills. "This doesn't seem to have dampened Leonardo's lust much," claims Mrs. June. She was quoted as saying, "I would feel his presence, even his strength of feeling when he wanted to make love. He was a competent lover and must have been on earth as well. But human love is more satisfying. With spiritual love, there is no warmth of flesh," she said.
The Handshake, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Polly was the sweetest, prettiest girl in Goldsboro, yes, sir. All the local boys were chasing her, and quite a number of the fellows from the surrounding countryside were, too. All the girls were jealous of Polly because they didn't have no sweethearts to take them to the local dances. They all wanted Polly to choose her man so things could go back to normal. But Polly was picky. None of the local boys suited her, and neither did the fellows from the backcountry. Then one day, George Dean came home from university, and Polly was smitten. Polly completely dropped all her other beaux when George came courting, and it wasn't long before George proposed and Polly accepted. Polly started making preparations for the wedding and shopping for items to fill her new home. George wasn't too interested in all the fripperies and wedding details. He left the womenfolk to get on with it and started spending time down at the pool hall with some of his buddies. And that's where he met Helene, the owner's saucy daughter. She had bold black eyes and ruby red lips and a bad girl air that fascinated George. He spent more and more time at the pool hall and less time with Polly, who finally noticed in spite of all the hustle and bustle. Of course, Polly was furious. She immediately confronted George with the story, and he couldn't deny it. Suddenly, George had to toe the mark. His pool hall visits were over, and he spent every free hour he wasn't at work by her side. That didn't sit well with George, but his family backed Polly up, so he went along with it. The day of the wedding dawned clear and bright. The guests filled the sanctuary, and the pastor and the best man waited patiently in the antechamber for the arrival of the groom. But George didn't come. Eventually, they went searching for the missing bridegroom, and found out he'd left town with Helene an hour before the wedding. With dread, Polly's mother went to tell her daughter what had happened. Polly, all bright and shining and lovely in her long white dress and soft wedding veil, turned pale when her mother broke the news. Then she stiffened, grabbing her left arm as a sudden pain ripped through it. She was dead from a massive heart attack long before she hit the floor. A few days later, Polly was buried in the churchyard, still wearing her white wedding dress and veil. The whole town came to the funeral and wept at the passing of such a beautiful young girl. George and Helene, who had spent the week happily honeymooning in the Outer Banks, arrived home at the very moment that the black-clad crowd exited the churchyard. Their arrival caused a commotion. The minister had to pull Polly's father off of George before he killed him, and both George and Helene's family disowned the couple right there on the street in front of everyone. The couple fled town in disgrace. Time passed, and eventually the scandal was forgotten, until the day George's father passed away. It was rumored that he was to be buried in the local churchyard, just a few blocks away from the girl who had almost become his daughter. Suddenly, the story of Polly's jilting was retrieved, and folks wondered aloud if George would dare attend his father's funeral. But George was too clever for them. He waited at an inn outside of town until it was dark, and then he went to the churchyard to pay his last respects to his father. As he unburdened himself at his father's graveside, George heard a sweet female voice calling his name.
"George, sweetheart."
George looked up in sudden hope. Was that his mother come to forgive him? Then he saw, rising up from a grassy mound under a spreading oak tree, a figure in a long white gown and a soft veil. Her eyes and her lips were yellow flames beneath the veil, and the rotted wedding dress glowed with a white-yellow light. It was Polly. George's body stiffened, shudders of fear coursing up and down his arms and legs. He put a shaking hand to his mouth and staggered backward, the other hand outstretched outward off the specter floating toward him. The spectral bride cackled with angry laughter and swooped forward until its hand closed over George's outstretched one in a terrible parody of a handshake. The grip of the spectral bride was so cold it burned the skin, and so hard that the bones crunched as it squeezed.
"Come along into the church, George,"
the glowing bride whispered. Through the veil, George could see maggots crawling in and out of Polly's flaming eye sockets.
"No, Polly, no!"
George screamed in terror. But he could not wrench his hand free. The ghost dragged him step by halting step toward the front door of the church. His hand was a red-hot agony of pain, though the rest of his body was shaking with cold. "No!" George gave a final cry of despair and wrenched again at the hand. And suddenly he was free. The spectral bride gave a roar of rage as George ran pell-mell down the church lane and out into the street.
"You're mine, George Dean. If not in this world, then in the next,"
the spectral bride howled after him. By the time George reached his room, the fiery pain in his hand and arm were seeping through his entire body. He rang desperately for the housemaid and begged her to send for a doctor. Then he fell into bed and stared at his hand, which was black and withered, as if it had been scorched long ago by a fire. Black and red streaks were climbing up his arm so fast he could almost see them move. George was unconscious when the doctor arrived, and the swelling was already extending into his chest and neck. There was nothing the physician could do. The injury was too severe and had spread too far. Within 2 days, George was dead. Polly had gotten her man at last.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.